Okay, welcome to class again. We've got a lot to talk about today, so I'll try to get started here promptly. Let's start with a bit of review. Why do we teach grammar? It teaches us to communicate clearly. It trains our mind. Right. I don't mind if you don't have the exact words. It builds reading comprehension, and it helps us learn other languages. What have been the largest influences on the English language? I'm thinking of two, you could give six. The Latin influence, specifically in the Norman conquest, but there were also other times when Latin influenced English. And the other has to do with the very foundation of English. The Anglo-Saxons, basically, they provided the basic framework of the English language. Yesterday, one of the grammar concepts we looked at were the four verb types. Can you give them to me and explain them? This is a test on me to see how well I taught them yesterday. Four verb types. Come on in. Hand out there on the chair, you're welcome to it. So what are the four verb types?
Action.
Action is one of the categories, but we can further subdivide action into more categories. I'm looking for the four major ones as taught in that troublesome lesson. Transitive, but we can split transitive down. Remember that. I'm not going to put that flowchart back up for the sake of time, but as they make their rounds, you can take a quick look at it again. Transitive active, transitive passive, that's two of them.
Intransitive complete.
And hey, you weren't even here yesterday, right? These people were. Great. And
transitive linkage.
Intransitive linking. Thank you. Transitive active, remember, passes the action to the direct object. John hit the ball. Transitive passive, the action is done to the subject. Sentence? You have to use John in the ball.
The ball was hit by John.
And intransitive linking, our verb is not action. It links to a predicate nominative or predicate adjective. So again, John in the ball. John was not the ball. Similar. That really doesn't matter. And intransitive complete, we have action, but nothing is receiving the action. John swung wildly at the ball. Happens, but no action there. Okay, I had three requests yesterday for grammar concepts. We want to look at those briefly today. If you have more, you may give them now or as it strikes you. Once we're through with that, we'll move on into today's handout, looking at some bad attitudes about grammar very quickly, and then nine practical points on how to teach grammar, and then at the end up with some of this neat stuff here. So just, I know you're curious about some of that, and that's okay. We'll try to get to it quickly here. And I'd better just do this before I forget. On the flow charts, my email, if you want them, so there you have it.
If you want a copy of these books.
Oh, you weren't in here. But you may not. You have to solemnly promise that you will not give copies of them to your students. They have to copy them by hand because that work is beneficial. At first, I told the class that I'm not going to allow them to have copies of it, but I kind of repented myself because they're a lot nicer when they're done with the computer. Okay, I want to look at diagramming first. When you diagram,
What do you need to start with? Yes, this is a trick question. If you answer wrong, I will embarrass you.
The verb?
Yes, thank you. You must start with the verb.
I am
not very happy with the upper grade levels of Christian like language arts. They don't teach their students that. I don't know about the lower grade. I hope and pray they do. But you need to start with the verb. Why? Because there are multiple nouns in the sentence. If you start with the subject, 8 out of 10 children are going to look at this sentence and say that what is the subject?
David.
And it's not. Start with the verb. And the verb is the easiest thing to pick out because you look for a word that shows
action
or being. So action, do you see something that can be done? And they'll say, please. Okay, show me please. Well, please can be a verb though, right? You have to be careful with that. Come. Okay, show me come. See, you can show it. So what is the verb?
Come and clean.
And then once you have your verb, who or what come and clean?
You.
You. In parentheses because it's understood. And now we can call for complements. Remember, one of the things students always forget is you will not have a direct object unless you have an action verb. Do we have action verb? Yes, we do in this case. You come whom or what? No, in transitive complete. You clean whom or what?
Newspapers.
By the way, what type of sentence is this by sentence type? Simple, compound, complex, or compound, complex?
Compound, complex.
Compound, complex. We have two independent clauses and one dependent clause in this sentence. So let's finish out this clause. Just call out the word and tell me where you want to put it.
The shredder are adjectives for newspaper.
The and shredded are adjectives under newspaper. Up is an adverb under clean. The last word that remains with this independent clause is David, which is a
noun of
direct address. I think Christian Light would have you put it up here. I was trained all around the staff, so that's my default position there. What's wrong with that diagram? One of the four things students always forget. Shredded is a participle. Must be on an elbow. Okay, now we have a dependent clause here. That your dog dragged in yesterday. What kind of dependent clause is it? Noun, adjective, or adverb?
Noun.
Noun clause? Okay, which function does it fill then? It's not a noun clause. It's an adjective clause. Which noun does it modify?
Newspapers.
Newspapers. What is the predicate of that clause?
Dragged.
Who or what dragged?
Dog.
Dog dragged whom or what?
Nothing.
Nothing. Now, one of you should have been a good sixth grader and said in. Okay. In. Can you feel in? What do we do with in? Adverb. Yesterday. Adverb. Your. That. What?
I can't remember for sure how to. But is that a difference too between round staff and ceiling? How they get started?
I don't think so.
Should go about the line between dog and newspapers.
Yes. Okay, now here's another difference between Rod and Staff and Christian Light. We're getting ready to do the second main clause here. Rod and Staff will teach you to come out on the same level as the first clause with a dotted line like this with your conjunction on it and come out like this. Christian Light has you run a dotted line down, across, down, like your conjunction on here. I like this better. because this is on the same level as this. Have I made my students change the way they do it? No, because they're so used to doing it that way. But have I changed? No, I'm too stubborn. So we're going to do it this way. Verb?
May go.
May go. Who or what may go?
You may go.
You may go. You may go whom or what? Nothing. Finish it out.
To tell is a prepositional phrase under may go.
Because it tells where you may go. So this phrase here you're saying modifies may go. Because it tells
where
you may go. It tells with whom you may go. Well, that's not a question that they're supposed to answer. It's got to tell how, when, where, or why to be an adverb. It's got to tell which is how many, what kind of, to be an adjective. We're getting into our next subject here, which is going to be adjective, adverb, confusion. But remember, it's an adjective phrase. But by the way, let's get this straight. The preposition is with. The object of the preposition is?
Fred.
Brother. Because Fred is?
A positive.
And a positive. Right. So, with brother. Okay, if this thing here is an adjective phrase, it has to come right after town. So let's say, and then you may go with your brother Fred to town. It doesn't flow quite nicely, but it's possible. So it is not an adjective phrase. It has to be an adverb phrase. I ran out of space here, but of course, brother here, of course, Fred behind that in parentheses. Did we get everything? Then tells when, of course. Okay. I don't like diagrams as sloppy, but.
Then again, you're not going to be grading this one, are you? Are we good with that? Is that correct?
Please.
Please, yes.
Right, we didn't miss that. What is please?
An adverb?
I'm not sure.
I think
it should go under
come. But
it does sort of. I think it's actually an independent element. Because grammatically it doesn't fit. It doesn't need to be there. And independent elements typically would be something like in here.
I think, but I did not research that very recently. This is a sentence I used earlier when I taught this class. I just, you know, it's on my notes. I did not re-diagram it last night, so I got caught on that. So that's what happens when you don't prepare properly. I thought I had. Anything more anyone would like to discuss on diagramming? Make them do the verb first. It is essential. Okay, let's look at adjective, adverb, confusion. I told you I've got a flow chart on that. I'm going to go over to this board here for that. And I'll put that in my writing here, right? And this is not a very refined flowchart, so take this thing home and work with it yourself. I'm going to put adjective here and adverb here. Now, you know that with adjective, adverb, confusion, we're going to look at single words first. The big questions are what question is answered, and then what part of speech do they modify? So, what question do adjectives answer? Go ahead. Here again, I had Rod and Staff in school. I taught Rod and Staff for 5 years. I taught Christian Light now for 2 years. And it's still in my head this way because this is the way Rod and Staff teaches it. It's not better or worse than Christian Light. It's just the way it's in my head. Adverbs tell.
How, when, where, why,
and occasionally to what degree. Just leave that all for now. So, what question? That's one thing they need to look at. The second thing is what is modified. Adverbs will modify
verbs
mostly. Also, other adverbs and tips. An adjective will modify nouns or pronouns. Which of those questions is most important? I haven't been able to decide.
You know, typically a student asks me, I can immediately tell what it is, and I can also tell which question is going to be easier to decide what it is, and so I'll usually use whichever question is going to get me where I want to go first, unless I feel that, you know, maybe the student's being lazy and he needs to, you know, then I just tell him, well, you know, figure out what question it answers and what part of speech it modifies, and I walk away, you know. But those are your two tests, basically. It is helpful
to know the eight noun functions in a sentence. There are eight places in a sentence where nouns can be used. Let's see if we can name them.
Subject.
Direct object.
Predicate nominative.
Indirect object.
Object of preposition.
Those are the five most common. The other three do not show up very often. We have one of them there. Noun of correct address. A positive. Oh, wait, two. Right. And the eighth one is the objective complement.
Are those flow sheets making their rounds? Okay, good. That's fine. I just wanted to make sure everyone got a chance to look at them. Now, another point that can be helpful in adjectives. By the way,
adjectives are much easier to pick out. And so deciding it's an adjective. If it's not an adjective, it's probably an adverb. I mean, it could be a preposition. It could, you know, but adjectives are easy to pick out. Partly because of their three positions. The most common position for an adjective is where?
Right before
the noun that modifies it. That's called the attributive position, if you want the official term. If they come right after, we call them a positive adjective. A positive adjective usually come in pairs set off with commas. There is absolutely no problem finding them. The dog, brown and shaggy, wagged his tail. Occasionally, a positive adjective will come alone when it refers to position, as in the room downstairs has not been cleaned. And those can be tricky, because downstairs tells where. It tells which room. So there your position is important. Your position for an adjective is the predicate position, the predicate adjective following the linking verb, and that's not that huge problem either, typically. Where do adverbs come? If they modify the verb.
Anywhere.
If they modify adjective or adverb, right before. Because then they're the adverbs of degree. And so there again, those are easy to pick out. These are easy to pick out. So here's the only real problem area often. Not always. Now, I'm running out of space here. It's not condensed enough. If we're dealing with adjective phrases and clauses, now this really should come down below, because what we put up here still applies. But remember that, we've got an adjective on this side. An adjective phrase or clause must come where? After the noun it modifies. You remember how we used that test over here? We weren't quite sure what this was. Move it away from the noun that it follows. By the way, if you've got a phrase or clause that does not follow a noun, it has to be adverb. Bingo. Now, there are noun clauses, okay? But noun clauses are a different ball of wax. And if students struggle differentiating noun clauses, they've got other deeper problems. You know, and you're probably going to be dealing with them on a whole other level. So typically, there's not a lot of confusion there. At least that's been my experience. An adverb phrase can be anywhere. phrase or clause. And now dealing more specifically with clauses, what do adjective clauses always begin with?
A relative pronoun.
A relative pronoun. Who's which that?
Or a relative adverb, when, where, and why. And they should memorize those.
Because, okay, here again, we have a clause, and we're not sure, is this clause adjective or adverb? Well, if it starts with because, what does it have to be?
Adverb. Because adverbs start with subordinating conjunctions. There's a big list of subordinating conjunctions. Do any of you make your students memorize them? I never did. You do? Good. I always thought it would be a good idea. I just never had the energy, I guess, to do it. My co-teacher last year had her fifth graders work on memorizing all the prepositions. So, I mean, it can be done. You just have to decide if you have the energy for it. Okay. Anything more on adjectives or adverbs? Third request was on verb mood. Mood for verbs, where did I put my notes on that now? Yes. Mood for verbs in English is not very important. If you look at the handout from yesterday, you will see that there are three moods in English: the indicative, the imperative, and the subjunctive. The indicative is all your regularly used verbs. You're just indicating something. 80-90% of verbs are indicative mood. Imperative, you know imperative sentences. Okay, so right here, these verbs are imperative because they're giving a command. Subjunctive is the strange one. The subjunctive mood is used to give statements that are contrary to known fact or belief. If I were 16, I could drive to work. Obviously said by a 15-year-old. Were there is subjunctive because it's not actually the case. And you notice how that is different. If I were 16, it's because the subjunctive does have different forms. In English, however, the forms of the subjunctive are in most cases exactly the same as the indicative. And so the differentiation between those moods really is a mental exercise only. But other languages, it's not the case. But when I studied Spanish, mood is important. The subjunctive is used in way more situations than it is in English, and it's conjugated quite differently. And so a basic understanding of the concept of mood, again, is helpful in learning another language. Do you need mood to have a proper grasp of English grammar? Absolutely not. Should you understand it if you study another language that uses mood? Yeah, you'll learn it then. Is sort of my take on that. The professor asks that his classes be attentive during the lecture. Be is subjunctive. He wants it to happen, and it might happen or not, but it's an expression of hope there. So that's, again, how that is. Anything more on these grammar concepts or anything else that is bugging you before we move on to attitudes? Okay, I have, for better or for worse, categorized people who don't like grammar into two categories, and maybe that's painting with too broad a brush, but there are people who have a bad or closed attitude about it. Your typical 8th grade boy, I ain't never going to use this stuff, I don't have to diagram. It's hard, it's dumb, it's useless. And then there are the people who simply don't understand it. Yeah, I know it's got a point, but it doesn't make sense to me. It's so hard. I just really don't like it. I'd rather go to science class. That's what I call the open or the ignorant attitude. And there probably are people who don't fit neatly into one of those categories. So how do we deal with the bad and closed attitude? Well, first of all, check your attitude. If you dislike grammar and they know it, that's worded wrongly. If you dislike grammar, they will know it, okay? And they're going to struggle with it too. If that's the problem, then please go ahead and fix it. Check others' attitudes next. There are homes that have a bad attitude towards grammar. Sometimes an entire school or church culture does. Maybe there are older siblings who say, oh, you're in eighth grade this year, that book is terribly hard. You can't do a lot about that if those are some of the attitudes you're working with. You simply do your best. And awareness, I think, can be a big help in that, in helping you to overcome that. And then check your students' attitudes. Remember that you are the God-placed authority in your classroom, and you have the right and the responsibility, I believe, to require cheerfulness and willingness. You can't force them to like it. Hopefully you can invite them to like it, but you can't, and you should, forbid complaining and whining, and why do we have to? I've heard of teachers who had the policy, if their students complained about diagramming or whatever, the assignment got bigger. And, you know, you learn real quick not to do that. What about the open or ignorant attitude? Well, conquer this one. This one is in your hands. You can do a lot about this one. First of all, in our attempts to conquer this attitude, learn to appreciate grammar. See the value of grammar. And that's been kind of the thrust of this whole class, those four reasons we have for teaching grammar. Apply the rules of grammar. Let it make you a more effective communicator and teacher. Number two follows right on the heels of that. Point B here, master grammar. Don't just know it, but master it. Go home and figure out what please is supposed to be in this sentence so you don't get caught up next time you diagram a sentence with it. Learn it thoroughly, both the easy and the hard, the rules and the exceptions, all of it. Immerse yourself in it. Accept the challenge of mastering participial phrases and elliptical clauses and substantives and all that stuff that strikes fear into people's hearts. Because again, you can't take your students to where you haven't been yourself. And I know we have other things to do and we have challenges to meet, but be an example to your students in work and in study and in figuring it out. You know, this is the last day of class, but if we would have class tomorrow, I would come back knowing where please belongs, or I would have talked to a lot of people who also didn't know first. You know, we've got to know this stuff for the sake of our students. Number three, enjoy grammar. I find grammar addictive. When I started teaching school, grammar was not my favorite subject. It was actually probably the bottom or next to the bottom. I never hated it. I'd way rather teach math or history. Well, to this day, I'd still rather teach history, but I think grammar is just about crowding math out. Not algebra. I love algebra better than that yet, but you know, just the common, simple math stuff. I'd rather teach grammar probably. And I've gotten addicted to it. If you want something to work on, and this is more with punctuation, but yeah, you've read it, Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. On the back cover, it has the joke about the panda who walks into the bar and shoots because the dictionary was mispunctuated. But you will laugh all the way through this book. Now, it was written from a secular perspective. There are some things in there that are not very appropriate. I read from it to my students, but I don't let my students read it. You'll understand why. And once you are addicted to grammar and love it, then that joy can flow out of your life and into English class, and hopefully they'll love it as well. Number four, teach grammar. You've been commissioned to do it, so do it. So how do we teach it? I have 9 points here on how to teach grammar. First of all, with joy. I just said that. Let the enjoyment you find in grammar flow out of your life and into your grammar class. Make it live. Make it live. Both. Teach it, number two, from within. Don't just parrot the textbook, especially if you're teaching upper graders. Typically, you know, an eighth grader has sufficient reading capability to read the lesson himself. I don't think you should have to read the lesson with him. You teach it. You make it come alive. You use examples, other ones perhaps, and better ones perhaps, that are in the book. You may have heard this before. You cannot teach effectively from the edge of the cliff of your knowledge. If you teach up to 8th grade, then I suggest you buy the 9th and 10th grade books and do them. That way your knowledge extends beyond your students' knowledge, and it gives you a better picture. You might say, I don't have time. Well, I know, but it's just a thought. Number three, teach from that which they already know. And this is borrowed from the 7 laws of teaching. You cannot teach someone, if you've never studied algebra, we're not going to start with quadratic equations. If your students have zero knowledge of English grammar, we're not going to start with diagramming compound complex sentences. Start with where they're at. Link the new to the old. Start your class with review and segue neatly into the new material. Objective complements is a beautiful place to do this. I don't know if you noticed that on the flow chart on complements, but objective complements are so similar to both subject and object complements, subjective and object complements, that they just, I have never, it's introduced in 8th grade, and I never had an 8th grade class that couldn't get it, because it just flows in so nicely. And then one day, I heard a veteran teacher, he had taught way longer than I had, saying how he doesn't get this thing about objective complements. Why do you have to learn it? It's kind of a difficult concept. I said, it's not. And we started looking at it. To do him justice, he had never taught it. He taught a lower level. But he kind of knew about the concept and it was up there kind of difficult somewhere. And all of a sudden, yeah, okay, there's nothing to it. Start with what they know. Lead them to where they need to go. Number four, teach with objectives. Many of our teachers' guides give us those objectives. But know what you're teaching. Are you just teaching lesson 39? Or are you teaching them, for example, to identify and diagram adjective clauses? Get it down to a sentence, to a verb statement, to verb whatever. Several of them, perhaps, but this is what I want them to get. Number five, teach with flow charts or other diagrams. Show it. The visual is powerful. It boosts memory, it boosts comprehension, it boosts retention. After I started using flow charts in grammar class, I asked my students what helps you learn grammar concepts best, and it was clearly flowcharts. They said the flowcharts, especially, you know, getting them, copying them. So by all means, use them. I don't want to say that that's the only thing you need and that's going to solve all your problems from here and forward, but I found them to be a powerful teaching tool. The other benefit of them, you have them copy them down. Now hopefully, you know, we can refine this thing a little bit, make it a little more concise, a little neater. But then have that on, say, index card. Index cards really work well. In their book, or if you're using light units, maybe taped to the side of their workstation or something like that. And then they say, I'm not sure if this is matched or whatever. Lead them to the process. It's right there. Yeah, very useful for further review. Number six, teach with simplicity. You need to understand it well enough to present it simply yet thoroughly. And I found that it wasn't until about the third year that I was teaching the same lessons that my teaching really started to coalesce and get a lot more simple and focused. And if you're here on your first or second year, don't let that discourage you. Just let that encourage you to stick in there until you get to that point as well. Sometimes the textbook, especially if you're teaching rod and staff, the lessons can be really long. It can be rather wordy and confusing and long. Well, you cut through that. I use a highlighter heavily in my teacher's guide. I highlight in yellow the stuff that's really important, in green the stuff that's not as important, and by about the fourth or fifth time through the book, you can open the book and just go down the highlighting and you've had class. Cut through the excess. Now that I'm teaching Christian light grammar, I find that sometimes they don't quite give enough explanation or quite enough examples, and so then you make up your own, write them in the margins, and you have them for next year. But teach with simplicity. Use short explanations. How short is short? Well, if you can get it down to one word, that's the best. Watch. They learn when you show them. Use simple examples. That is C. Okay. Point A was use short explanations. B is use simple terminology, or at least defined terminology. There's nothing wrong with talking about substantives in 8th grade grammar class. Actually, you need to because you have lessons on substantives. But make sure they know what substantives are, and I just realized I didn't make sure of that myself. Maybe most of you are middle grade teachers and you don't know what a substantive is. A substantive is a word or group of words that fills a noun function in a sentence. So, I erased those 8 noun functions. That's a substantive. And that really does go along with that thing of making sure to link the new material to the old material. Make sure you define your terms. Do better than that than I just did. Use simple examples. I told you about John and the Ball and the fun we have with that. Use what works for you. Use their names. Involve it in their lives. Johnny raises rabbits, so talk about Johnny and the rabbits. Don't say, "Today's lesson is a little hard. It took me a while to get it last night. I hope I can make it clear to you." Why? Because I have found that spin, or the way in which you present something, is everything. Well, almost everything. If you open to objective compliments and tell them, "Now this is a new thing that you've never studied before, and they only give it to you in 8th grade, you know, the 6th and 7th grade, they don't have this, so I'm really going to try to make sure you can get this," their guards immediately go up. Oh boy, here we go, especially if they don't like grammar. But if we say, "Hey, you remember subjective compliments, you know, predicate nominatives and predicate adjectives, and you remember object compliments, you know, direct objects and indirect objects. Well, we have a third kind of compliment today, and it's kind of like a cross between the two, and so we call them objective compliments." You know, the "if" in subjective means relating to. A subjective compliment relates to the subject. An objective compliment that we have today relates to the direct object. There's your lead-in for that lesson. The thing is, if you don't quite understand the lesson, if the lesson is a little hard and it took you a while to get it last night and you hope you can make it clear to them, they'll catch on soon enough. You don't have to tell them. Number 7, teach with student participation. No participation equals no learning. In almost every case when I'm diagramming on the board, they are telling me what to write. With upper graders, I rarely actually get them to the board myself. That's probably a flat spot that I should do better at. My personal opinion is it's more important with lower and middle graders. But somehow, get them participating. Get them copying down the flowcharts. Get them telling you what to do. Get them to the board. Make them work. Don't let the fact that I don't do that discourage you from doing it. Either way, get them involved, because no participation equals no learning. If you can, take the rule that you have, condense it into something simple and catchy, and say it, and then have them say it. If you can, even get it into a bit of a chant, and after a while they have it. A little bit like I've been doing, well, not exactly. I have this list of 4 things students never remember, and I have them chant those things to me. Because just the fact of chanting them, it's amazing how they still forget them, but it has really helped. Point 8, teach with review. Review is the key to retention. Just a practical point I found out the hard way with the Rod and Staff Grammar course: if you do not use the oral review, which is in the teacher's section, and the class practice, and the review exercises, you're going to have a little bit of trouble with mastery. If you're having trouble getting through, cut back on written exercises before you cut back anywhere else. 1 year, for sake of time, I would skip the oral review if I felt they understood it, and I would allow them to do even numbers in review exercises. And about a month down the road, why don't they remember this stuff? I stopped that, and things improved. Okay, here are the 4 things students never remember. I put this under this point because I reviewed it with them all the time. This is not necessarily comprehensive. Your students might be different. But the 4 things I have are that the subject of a sentence is never found in a prepositional phrase. Have you ever had any trouble with that? The second one, there is no direct object without an action verb. I think I mentioned that one several times. I don't know how many diagrams I've checked with the verb "is" and a straight line behind "is." You won't have it. The third one is that introductory adverb clauses must be set off with a comma. That sentence I had on the board yesterday with all those mistakes intentionally in it, someone pretty much right off the bat snapped, caught onto that thing that we had an introductory adverb phrase there that was not set off with a comma. Sorry, introductory adverb clause. I missaid that. An introductory adverb clause must always be set off with a comma. An introductory adverb phrase must be if it's long. So, before we eat, go and pick up the toys. You need a comma after eat. Even though it's only three words, you need a comma there because it's a clause. What about after dinner the men went into the living room? This is an example from this book. And she tells how the writer and the editor argued over whether or not to put a comma after dinner. It's a phrase, and it's a short phrase, so technically you don't have to. But the writer insisted because he needed to give the men time to push their chairs back and stand up. So there's room for variation in some of that. The fourth thing is diagram participles on elbows. Anyway, so for what it's worth, those I found to be frequently forgotten points.
What was the third one?
Introductory adverb clause must be set off with a comma. And number nine, teach with diligence. Require diligence from them in trying and digging and working. But sometimes, despite your best efforts, they don't get it. And you have to come back later and teach it again. But in the meantime, you be diligent. Study it and come back with a fresh and better approach. And help them master it the second time through. Point C, when should I teach it? I don't really have a lot on this. Obviously, teach it in grammar class. You'll have to decide based on your curriculum and the length of your school year how often you're going to do this. My second point on this is teach it all the time. Be an example of good grammar in other classes, at recess, when you speak publicly, so on. Where should I teach it? Obviously at school. Make sure you don't have distractions. Make sure they're with you. That should go without saying, but somehow children don't seem to realize the importance of that. Whether you want to or not, you are teaching grammar everywhere. You know, Sunday school class. Someone who isn't a teacher defined this word. You know, all that stuff, you know, or, hey, you're a teacher, what about this over here? People do that. I had someone tell me, accept that graciously. It's one of the perks of being a teacher, but don't let it go to your head. And don't become a grammar Nazi, the type of guy who's just picking people's grammar apart just because he can and knows it. Why should I teach grammar? Well, it's required, obviously. I teach it because I enjoy it. And then we have those four reasons. Okay, anything more now before we conclude with some of the joy of grammar, some of the oddities of our language? We have 8 minutes left. And what I have doesn't need to take that much time, but we can hit that right now, and then if you have something more, we can look at it then. In what other language do your feet smell and your nose run? That's an English oddity. Can you make sentence from this? Buffalo, 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 buffalo. Well, I have the explanation sort of written out there on your handout, but understand that there are three meanings of the word buffalo, possibly more. There's a city, Buffalo, New York, and that is here and here. Okay. Then there's the verb buffalo, which means to intimidate or bully or be not nuts. Okay. And then there's the animal, the bison. And what we have in this sentence is an adjective clause with the relative pronoun understood. You know, we can't leave that in there because it ruins the effect. So basically what we have is there are bison from the city of Buffalo that other bison from the city of Buffalo intimidate. And this first group of bison from the city of Buffalo intimidate other bison from the city of Buffalo. So you have three groups of bison from Buffalo, and the group two is intimidating group three because group one intimidates them. You know, so once you understand it, you can actually read it with some expression. Buffalo, 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 buffalo.
And this is another very similar one. The rat, the cat, the dog bit, chase, escaped. Theoretically, that's correct. The rat escaped that the cat chased, or no. The cat that the dog bit chased a rat that escaped. There's no good way to put that in one sentence, really, unless you want to create a statement like they did there.
Hyphens are terrifically important. The first day, I think there were about 24 people in this class, so there were 20-odd students in here. No, there weren't. There were plenty odd students in here. You were in Joseph Miller's class this morning. What was the mistake there in that email conversation?
Resend.
Resend needs to be written like this. That is the correct way of writing it. You write it the way he wrote it. Yeah, it is resent. Sorry.
Pupils entrance. How many people go to your school?
That is a terrifically common one. Check out Programs for Teachers Institute. Teachers Institute. Watch where they put that apostrophe. So, who is mad? You can make good away. The convict said the judge is mad. Or the convict said the judge is mad. This is a good one.
You all agree with that?
Right, so let's punctuate it like this. Y'all okay with that? Is that better?
It both fits.
That example also comes from Me Shoots and Leaves, and there are many, many more. Charles I walked and talked half an hour after his head was cut off. Charles I walked and talked, period, half an hour after his head was cut off. Point C there, I think there are 11 heads in a row there, and the hyphen or the italicized words there for the ones that are the subject of discussion, I think, make it clear what's going on there. I mentioned point D yesterday, I think it was, I like peanut butter pie better than you. I like peanut butter pie better than you like peanut butter pie. But it's a good two-sided statement there. Why is grammar important? Well, who hasn't enjoyed a good book? I love reading. Probably too much sometimes. Who hasn't been moved by the power to convince in persuasive writing? Who hasn't been thrilled by the music inherent in a well-written poem? But most importantly, who hasn't experienced the blessings of the words of life, God's own words, changing and cleansing, inspiring and exciting you? That's why I teach grammar. And again, Habakkuk 2, verse 2, make it plain that he may run that readeth it. And we hope you'll come back to Teachers Institute next year, too. That was a sign in China. We assume that their Chinese script was a little more accurate than that. Their translation wasn't the best. But either way, this is the exit, and we wish your next coming. We've got about 2 minutes until the last bell. Anything else you would like to discuss or clarify or talk about? There is nothing and no one saying you cannot leave now. Thank you for coming and for participating. God bless your school year. Mm-hmm.